Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Possessed of an unnatural and legendary hunger, the Reapers have come to Earth to establish a new order, built on the harvesting of enslaved human souls. They rule the planet. They thrive on the scent of fear. And if it is night, as sure as darkness, they will come.
Graphic Audio presents E.E. Knights, Vampire Earth.
Narrated by Ken Jackson. Performed by Tim Getman, Thomas Penny, James Keegan, Christopher Graybill, Julie Ann Elliott, Mort Shelby, Michael Glenn, Dan Stevens, Richard Rowan, Christopher Sheeran, Greg Gorton, Nanette Savard, Thomas Keegan, Joe Brack, Barbara Pinolini, Tim Carlin, Ren Casey, Casey Platt, Terrence Aselford, Joseph Thornhill, James Lewis, Stephen Carpenter, MJ Casey, Elizabeth Jernigan, David Coyne, Tony Nam, Drew Copus, James Konacek, Dolores King Williams. Vampire Earth, Book 7, Fall with Honor. Forward Operating Base Rally, Missouri, September, the 54th year of the Kurian Order. The Show-Me State has a flat boot heel stomping a corner of northeast Arkansas. Those who pass through the region remember only a flattish stretch of midwestern farm country running along the river, pierced by bayous and bisected by interstate. There's little to distinguish it on the surface. But beneath the good topsoil, the boot heel fascinates on a geologic scale. It is home of the New Madrid fault line that gave way in the chaos of 2022, causing the Mississippi to run backward as far north as St. Louis. The destruction that resulted from the earth writhing like a heavy sea made the region ill-omened. Everyone who could move did, to the better preserved areas of Missouri at first, and then south or farther west once the Grog showed up. Then came Southern Command. The few Kurian lords organizing the area fell rather easily, surprised by the strength and tenacity of the guerrillas. With the Kurians gone, the area became another fought-over piece of no-man's land between the Mississippi and the Ozark Free Territory, not as well patrolled as the Tennessee-Little Rock Corridor, or as danger-filled as the bushwhack country in southern Missouri. A powerful smuggler named Shrivastava set up shop around an old fireworks warehouse, running whatever he could between the Kurian Zone, Grogs, and Free Territory. He's long since retired to the older family holdings on a remote piece of Carolina coastline, but a nephew still runs the business, now under the probing noses of Southern Command forces directed by the new United Free Republics. Rally Base, set up just down the road, as though keeping the post company, is only a couple of acres in size, including the filling ground outside the wire and blockhouses. Of course, the business isn't quite as profitable these days. There's no more smuggling of captive souls into the Kurian Zone, or anti-tank rockets capable of taking out small watercraft up to the Grogs. But thanks to the soldiers at Rally Base, there's also less of a chance of a team of Reapers coming through and killing everyone who doesn't make it down the hidey hole in time, or of Grogs looking to prove themselves in battle, killing security men and stealing livestock. Shrivastava and family have shifted with the trade and opened a tiny brewery, soap mill, and bakery, growing rich on a few dozen lesser transactions a day rather than the bigger scores the old man saw. Civilization, after a fashion, has returned. The family business is well off enough to hire hands to take care of the endless outside labor that keeps the bake stove burning and the meat locker filled. One of their hands, a lean, bronze-skinned man with a thick head of black hair tied back from his sweating face, works shirtless in the dust of the firewood pile, reducing holes to quarters with a shining axe. His lower back is a topographical map of old burns. His face is scarred from the right eye down, and there's something a bit off about his jaw. If he were talking, you'd guess he'd just said something ironic. He had the look of an outdoor man who knows the optimum operating speed of his body, operating with a precise economy of effort that would do a machine credit. He moves with a hint of a limp as he retrieves another hole for the spitting stock. The way he stiffens when one of the daughters of the house comes out to throw potato peelings in the pig meal suggests that he's a hard man to sneak up behind. The slight unconscious shift in his grip of the axe suggests that it might even be dangerous. David Valentine would always remember it all beginning, the day he got his first gray hair. Or, to be more accurate, the day he noticed his first gray hair. Three of them, in fact. For some reason, all of them decided to erupt on his right temple. He'd used the mirror to shave that morning, as he had to go over to the fort to teach, and picked them out as he combed his hair back. They reminded him of his father. His mother had never gone gray, but he had only a vague idea of her age when the Valentine clan died. His father had lots of them, which was natural for a man of 56. 56 was what Father Max had burned into the cross, anyway. He chopped firewood for Father Max from the age of 11 until he joined up with the cause at 17. Valentine wiped the axe clean with an oilcloth and leaned it up against the tool shed. Galaxy Supply read the reversed letters running the roofline of the big trading post, bakery, diner, and repair shop. All the buildings of Galaxy Supply except the family home were painted in a durable barn red, though someone with an artist's eye had added white and green accents around the door and barred windows, with smaller decorations depicting grapevines and cheery songbirds. An unusually hot late September day was working up. The sun was hardly blocked at all by decades-old particles riding the upper atmosphere. Some said the sky was washing itself. Others maintained the haze had swirled off to the southern hemisphere for a few years and would be back, the way it had returned in 43. He'd sweated enough to discard his shirt, both to preserve its condition, he had to teach at the base today, and to keep himself cool. He used a bucket, a rag, and some of the milky Srivastava soap to clean himself up in the outside sink before heading inside for his breakfast. The two Srivastava girls dodged nimbly around the kitchen. There had to be more dodging these past few days in the baking kitchen than usual. Mr. Srivastava had extracted an old pizza oven from an establishment up the interstate toward Cairo and was converting it to wood fire. Welding tools and tanks were interspersed with the usual bread racks. The girls, rich black hair bound up in kerchiefs to keep the flour out, didn't give him a second look. They had teenage soldiers swaggering out their first forward duty to make eyes at daily, and Valentine was coming up on 33, battered and dragging a leg. Besides, he was hired help. Not that it would have done him much good to be 18 again. He'd been too shy to flirt back then. He would have just discreetly admired their caramel skin and wide, inviting eyes from the other side of the pastry case. Valentine had toast and eggs for breakfast, with a side of peppery okra left over from last night's dinner, with real black tea. The family liked tea, and through their trading connections, had some strong blend that left a far more pleasant aftertaste than coffee. The fresh food was why he worked for the Srivastava clan, rather than living in civilian squats blistered off the base.
Finish the firewood so fast?
Mrs. Srivastava loved Valentine to death, though in her case, love manifested in cramming food down his throat. As soon as he cleared one plate, she'd appear with another, and if he didn't dig into that with enough gusto, he sometimes worried that she'd ram it in with one of the long wooden spoons she used to fill his dish, then hold his nose until he swallowed.
Wasn't too hard to finish that quick. Out of timber. I'll take the mule team out tomorrow and get some more trees.
Pines and poplars had reclaimed the Boot Heel farmland, but the cleared ground almost neighboring Rally Base meant a drag to fill the winter dry racks.
Why not? Oh, I forget. Today is one of your days at the fort.
I should get cleaned up.
Use the washroom with the running water. Nice to have the smell of a young man's shaving soap here. I hope my daughters take note.
Is it my fault Patrick would rather be a soldier than a storekeeper?
Valentine slipped down the hall toward the full bath. Patrick was something of a tender spot in the family conversation. Letters from him had ceased altogether 6 months before. When he hired on with Srivastava, giving an abbreviated version of his service history, the girl had quietly asked him how often men declared missing in action returned. Fresh back from Kentucky, Valentine couldn't offer much hope. especially since he'd just spent months in Kentucky seeking another missing soul. Valentine relished the heated water in the family bathroom. The rest of the help had to make do with the stove-warmed water in the bunkhouse. As he buttoned his shirt, he searched the sink for stray hairs and soap residue. Mrs. Srivastava might like the smell of this young man's shaving, but it would be rude to repay her graciousness with a dirty basin. With his teaching satchel slung over his shoulder, Valentine walked over to the base, taking his time in the unseasonable heat. The sentry at the gate stepped out from the shade of his corrugated iron hut, nodding towards Valentine. Though the guard knew Valentine's face and alias, he still checked the ID provided by Stiakowski's specialists. His eyes were unreadable behind his wraparound sunglasses.
Name?
Argent. Max.
Base is on alert. We got a sidearm and a carbine for you, if you don't have your own.
Thank you.
Valentine's weapons were arranged in netting hanging from the unnailed floorboards of his bunkhouse. He visited the base as a civilian expert, and at the moment his boots and pocket knife were the only military issue items he had.
No drill.
The sergeant handed Valentine a pistol belt with magazine harness. He was heavy as a side of beef, and Valentine couldn't remember him pulling a shift in the guard hut before.
How's a Model 4?
I qualified. This serious?
Heavy river traffic reported. It may have landed.
The sergeant made a notation of the gun's serial numbers. Valentine had heard a largish patrol go out in the pre-dawn, but had thought nothing of it. Pizarro was an experienced enough forward area base commander to make sure nothing left or entered his base by regular schedules.
The CO wants you to come by his office after your class.
Can do.
Valentine headed into the base, where windows were being filled with sandbags, and extra men idled in the shade at the mortar positions, ready to get the tubes into action as soon as orders came down. The quick step of the men carrying the sandbags and the lack of joking put Valentine on edge. He had militia today, mostly young men fresh from a year or two with labor regiment, unless the boys or girls were lucky enough in their LR term to get apprenticed into a technical field. They were dumped into the militia pool and made miserable enough that joining the regulars seemed like an elevation to paradise. Some stuck out militia service for a 4, 6, or 8 year term in return for land and tools, a stake in some new community and land won from the Kurians. Only 6 years, and the militias rotated a lot of soldiers through good vocational training. Texas had huge swaths of fallow land to fill with stakes. If the former militiamen were lucky, they never heard the words, or such time and duty as the needs of Southern Command require. He had two classes, a basic literacy and science group fresh out of the bush, and his advanced class, who was learning about Southern Command and how he'd hoped to disassemble the grim Kurian order surrounding the embattled freeholds. Today would be his advanced group. They met in a dining hall, a wood-framed building with a roof and canvas sides, pulled up now to admit the breeze. Valentine had drawn a misshapen pyramid of figures on his blackboard. It rather reminded him of the ranks of invading aliens he'd seen in a video game at the Outlook back in the Cascades. He leaned against the front table.
So, that's it. There's a reason pyramids last so long. They're stable, wide at the bottom and thin at the top.
The men and a sprinkling of women, mostly first-year recruits growing their hair back in, save for a couple who went the other direction and shaved down to bald, took notes on loose paper. Because of the alert, each had his rifle on the table within reach, combat harness hanging off the back of the chair. The platoon sergeant could form them up in a few seconds.
Bottom is the population in the Kurian zone. Middle-level functionaries direct and take care of them. At the cream level, you've got those trusted with weapons and the people watching the functionaries. Above them are the Reapers, the eyes and ears and appetites of the Master Kurian at the top. What's the weak point?
The alien at the top!
Physically, you're correct. If you've got your hands on him, it's about as easy to kill a Kurian as a chicken. Good stomping is all it takes. It's the getting at them that's dangerous.
Valentine turned, lifted his shirt, and showed some of the burns running his back.
They usually live in towers that are very hard to get into. Complete with bolt holes and escape tubes that you can't fit down if you're bigger than a bobcat. About as easy to catch as running water.
You got three. Or was it four?
Hoke was a second-yearer who'd been an early Doubting Thomas at his classes, wondering how a rather beat-up civilian worked up the nerve to lecture soldiers, until a lieutenant with an interest in the hunters took the sophomore warrior aside during a break. Valentine's wolf-sharp ears had picked up the conversation.
But what is he? Wolf, cat, or bear?
All you need to know is that he's dangerous, Hoke.
I got three, but the last was sort of unofficial.
Valentine didn't count the Kurian he wasn't sure of in the sunken sub off his Paniola.
Getting back to my point, it's the Reapers we try to hit. Yeah, they're the most dangerous thing on two legs you're ever going to meet. But they're the connection between the Kurian and the Quislings. The Kurian feeds, gives orders, and judges all through his pale-skinned avatar. If you can get one just after a feed, or in a hole far from the Kurian avoiding daylight, you've got a chance. If you can put enough lead on target and get in with explosives, or a well-swung axe.
They run from sunlight, right?
Sunlight doesn't hurt them one bit, Hoke. It messes with the communication with its master, though, like static. They sense us because intelligent living beings give off something we call life sign. They can hone in on it at night. That's the whole point of those breathing exercises we've been doing at the beginning and end of each class. Getting you guys trained so they might mistake you for a paddock of horses or a pack of wild pigs.
Valentine felt jealous of their youthful confidence. The first Reaper is easy. It's the second that makes you shit your pants, went an old saying from the wolves. There was a time when Southern Command left killing Reapers to the hunters. But the Life Weavers, brothers to the otherworldly Kerr, but their mortal enemies, who trained the hunters, had been scattered during Solon's brief occupation of the Ozarks. Valentine was an advocate of giving more of the rank and file of Southern Command at least the basics of first avoiding and then dealing with the Reapers, and Pizarro agreed, giving him an occupation until Highbeam could get going. If Highbeam would ever win approval. It was one thing to raid into the Kurian zone, quite another to establish a new freehold, especially one so close to the great nerve trunks of the Kurian Order. Valentine brought himself back to the here and now of his class.
There's another reason for going after the Reapers. A lot of times, the Quislings aren't even sorry to see one offed. Sure, your diehard churchmen will still damn you to the cleanup crew, but everyone else is walking around a little easier. On the other side of the river, they don't have guns, don't have grenades, and a lot of times they aren't even allowed to have locks on their doors. If you're lucky, you'll see a couple of Reapers before you muster out at a distance, usually running away. Quislings see the Reapers all the time, poking around at night with the full authority of the KZ behind them. They've got to talk to them.
Valentine walked past a sandbagged observation point camouflaged to look like another water tank. A pair of soldiers had set up a twin-lensed rangefinder just poking above the rim of the tank like the antenna of a lead ant checking the exit from the nest. Wires dangled from the phony tank, running to the underground PVC tube leading to the mortar pits. The command building was two units of prefabricated housing, easily ported by trailer and then joined, its outline concealed under a mesh of netting and some young trees. A dugout stood just opposite, its door open and beckoning thanks to the alert. Colonel Pizarro stood leaning against the frame. He had lined, leathery skin, but very bright eyes that reminded Valentine of the comical little goggle-eyed walnuts the church youth groups sold as fundraisers. He wore a flak jacket and combat harness, and a carbine like Valentine's swung from his shoulder.
Let's take a walk, Argent.
He led Valentine out to the two layers of perimeter wire. Most officers had a bit of military business that either irritated or obsessed them. Pizarro's was base security. He didn't like the idea of anything leaving or coming into his station without his knowing about it. He liked to walk the wire as he talked, rather than stay cooped up in his office. According to his staff, he'd been in an interrogation camp during Solon's occupation of the Ozarks, which was enough being boxed up for a lifetime. Pizarro checked some frayed wiring on a quartz lamp. Valentine looked at the manufacturing stamp. It had originated in Mexico City.
You want the good news or the bad?
The good first. Otherwise, it's like drinking bourbon out of a shaving mug.
All I ever see you drink is milk or coffee. When we go off alert, stop by.
Is that the good news? Alert called off?
You're messing up your ordering. Let's stick to the good news. I've got a courier packet. Highbeam is on. I have this from Lambert herself. I've got to punch your ticket and give you escort to the staging briefing. Even my staff doesn't know this yet, and I want to keep it that way. But this post will be point zero. You'll set off from here. If it wasn't for the alert, we'd already be laying plumbing for a new camp.
Was that the good news or the bad?
Thought you'd be pleased to hear that all that scouting you've been doing in Kentucky is about to pay off.
I never found what I was looking for.
And...
Anka.
Sorry. Not much with grog talk. Sounds like dogs snarling at each other to me.
So, what's the bad news?
I'm sealing the base. First recon reports are in. It's a strong grog column out of the Cairo area. It's those gangly, hunched-over ones with the pig-ugly faces. They're avoiding contact and mostly hunting and scavenging. There aren't many settlements up that way, but I'm getting reports of thievery. Stealing livestock and chickens and whatnot. Anything they can sneak off with when no one's looking. Some folks have disappeared, but we're not sure if they've run or the grog's got them.
Double Bloods, they call themselves. Odd of them to come across the river like that. They keep to themselves.
You spent some time in Illinois. Anything else you can tell me?
The Illinois Guard has a lot of stations around Mount Vernon, keeping watch on the Double Bloods. I had someone in the Illinois Guard I wanted to meet.
Who was that?
Sergeant Heath Hopkins. He died badly.
So they're neutrals.
Pizarro had enough troubles with the big gray grogs inhabiting the riverbanks on his side of the Mississippi, the lonely Currian Tower watching river traffic from Cairo, and the Currians on the other side of the twisting river in Kentucky and Tennessee. Valentine wasn't surprised that he didn't know much about the Double Bloods. There were pissworthy fires closer to the colonel's feet. Valentine dredged up his very limited experience.
More like they hate everybody. Currians tried to make a half-grog, half-human, and it didn't work out. They're ill-tempered, even for grogs, so the Currians planted them on the borders of Southern Command, hoping they'd be trouble for us. Problem is, they all remember which direction the trucks that brought them came from. And it wasn't southwest.
Can you savvy their lingo?
No more than a few phrases they use to communicate with the other grogs, but I'd rather not walk into the camp. This could be a man raid.
Now what?
They're Amazons. Something amiss with their reproductive system. Not many male embryos live to be birthed. The ratio is 4-6-1 or thereabouts, if the Illinois Guard has the numbers right. There are problems up and down the Double Blood genetic line, and the only way they're sure of a live birth is with a human donor and a Double Blood female. Inbreeding worsens the defect. They're smart enough to grab new males now and then.
Good God.
It's not so bad. I hear they stick two layers of bagging over your head. Insurance.
What kind of weaponry are we talking about?
Just small arms for fighting. They hunt with bows or crossbows and slingshots. They'll carry explosives to blow open locked doors. Tell your patrols to keep their distance.
I just as soon discourage raids. What kind of casualties do we have to inflict to turn them around?
It's not that simple. Like I said, they're ornery. If they spill blood down here, a feud will start, and a good feud can go on for years.
They're invading us. What do they expect to happen?
Logic and tribal custom? Ne'er the twain shall meet. Right now, you're just other. Start skirmishing and you'll be enemy. Your other option is to kill every last one of them. Then they'll think the gods punished them for arrogance. But you know how hard it is to run down grogs who've gone bush.
I better get to the communication center then. Anyway, this is your chance to get out if you like. Nobody will say anything if you show up for the high beam or whatever the crap they're gonna call it conference a week or so early. Otherwise, it'll be rally-based cooking for you for a few days until whatever business the Double Bloods want to start finishes.
I'm not one to leave a bunch of kids I trained behind in a crisis. Can you shelter the Srivastava clan?
Srivastava? Of course. But it'll take more than a bag over his head to get him hot to abandon his store and stock.
Trader Srivastava may have been a civilian, but there was something of Valentine's old captain, Lahav, in him. He had a gentle manner, masking a pirate avarice, but it didn't make him any less outraged at the idea of hiding behind locked gates while the Double Blood stole from his pens and coops. Valentine spoke to him in the arms room, the one part of the store back in the family quarters. Racks of rifles and pistols lined the walls, and reloading tools filled a long workbench. A back exit from the room led down to a tunnel to a separate basement, the family's reaper-proof shelter in an old underground gas tank. His 9-year-old son sat behind, loading bullets from boxes into fresh new magazines. The whole family knew the story of Grandfather Dirty, who held 2 reapers off with a shotgun while the rest of the clan fled to the vault-like underground shelter. The grandfather had been the only loss that night.
The fort? This building is tougher than it looks, young man. Both basement and attic have firing slits to cover my property.
If you draw blood, they'll be back to avenge it.
Then I will draw more blood, young man. Yes, let them return. I welcome all at my store, provided they pay for what they take. These creatures will pay for my stock one way or another.
Valentine wondered if it was too late to catch that transport to the conference. Ray, the trading post's butcher, appeared, an old army flak jacket draped over a beefy arm. He accepted an old M16 from his employer. The boy passed him a bag of magazines.
You take the wall covering the back door, Ray. You taking a gun, Valentine? Or will you stay in the Reaper proof with the mothers and children?
Maybe the Double Bloods would let Valentine guide them to a bottom that contained a sizable herd of wild pigs. They could get all the side meat they wanted and carry off the young.
I'm going to go talk to the Double Bloods.
No, young David. Do not waste yourself in that manner. My great-uncle went to set up a post with the White Fangs up beyond the ridge. They ate him. I do not call you a coward.
I need to move out. There should be enough daylight left to get over the ridge.
Maybe. With a fast enough pair of wheels. Within an hour, Valentine had convinced Pizarro to loan him a driver and transport, plus a big bag of supplies. Scaring off coyotes with wolves? Pizarro had liked the idea. He arranged on the spot for a motorcycle, his best two-wheel man, fuel, survival gear, even priceless comm gear. They'd worry about the paperwork later. Valentine wanted to kiss him, remembering his days in the wolves. If Southern Command had a Pizarro at every forward post, the wolves would spend more time raising hell on Kurian's own backroads and less cadging for supplies.
You're not bad back there, sir!
Callislow, his driver, sat at the front of the big Harley. Harley Davidson still produced up in Milwaukee, and this specimen had found its way into Southern Command's motor pool. Fat-tired, with a high clearance and rugged brush brakes and plenty of horsepower and hookups for attachments, it was meant to hold a sidecar, maybe even one of the dark-canopied blisters for a Reaper, or to pull a one-body medical sled. The old road, now not much more than a potholed deer trail, wasn't enough to slow down Callislow's urging. Valentine had tied two small staffs of pig iron to the rear backrest gear bar. A white flag fluttered at one, a netted bag of Texas oranges on the other. Though each man had a carbine, they'd slung them facing down and backward, further proof of peaceful intent. Not that it wouldn't stop an ambitious young White Fang from trying to knock them both off the bike with a single 50-caliber bullet, thought Valentine, as they bumped up Bad Blood Ridge. Valentine's active imagination felt the notched foresight of a rifle resting on his eye, wondered if some poor, horny, unmated grog would ignore the signals for parley. The noise the bike made must be drawing White Fang scouts like the musical ice cream wagons of the KZ lured children to the new Universal Church ice cream that had proselytizing cartoons and homilies on the wrappers. Callislow spotted them first as they came off Bad Blood, bouncing down a gravelly wash under the gaunt, nest and vine-draped skeletons of power pylons. The bleached skulls alternated with femurs and tibias hung from one long arm, threaded on old wire. A bent, loose-skinned old White Fang stood atop a fallen hickory, his long rifle gripped in the exact center but held stiff-armed toward them. Some females watched from the other side of the log. One, younger or more daring, climbed even higher than her male guardian to get a better look. She bore a bulging harvesting bag.
Pull up, Callislow.
Roger that!
Point the bike so it's parallel to his rifle, not pointed into White Fang land.
Callislow swung the bike's rear tire so that it faced toward White Fang territory. The old grog's testicular sack was well below his loincloth line in the heat.
Leathery old hangball!
That's good for us. Foragers mean one of the tribe's bigger camps are around.
Valentine walked to the back of the Harley, producing some signaling mirrors given as trade goods, tough squares of chrome on lanyards, with his right hand. In his left, he held a selection of Texas Coast oranges in a net bag. He had several boxes of matches in reserve. He'd yet to meet a grog that didn't love to strike a match, just from the pure dazzle and power of instant fire creation.
Foot pass! Parley!
Valentine tried the lingua franca of St. Louis. The females craned their necks, seeing what he had to offer. The male scratched an itch under his loincloth and thought, but his eyes didn't leave the oranges.
I think we're good.
The grog planted his gun stock and gave an unmistakable get over here sweep of his arm.
Shit. I'd almost rather be shot at.
They arrived about an hour before sunset. The humans walked the bike in with the help of one of the females. They wore soup cans around their necks, indicating that they'd come in peace and offered up tokens and gifts to be allowed on White Fang lands, the footpath of Grog commerce and diplomacy. The White Fang encampment stood in an old field with an irrigation trench on three sides and thick woods on the fourth. Clay pots stood upstream for drinking water, and laundry lines hung downstream. Old books hung on the bushes, shielding the toilet area where the ditch drained off. The White Fang villagers lived in tents made of pulled-up carpeting and quilts of plastics, weatherproofed with beeswax or musky-smelling oil. Human captives hewed wood, made charcoal, and carried water. They looked at the newcomers with pleading eyes. Valentine avoided their gaze. Nothing you can do about it at the moment. A group of young males, unblooded and untattooed, glared or hopped up and down in excitement, letting out little war cries. The younger females taunted by slapping their own backsides or spitting in the embassy's direction.
Lots of unmated groggies.
Pizarro had picked Calislo because he knew something of the grogs, but Valentine would have preferred a little less experience. The man was just finding things to be nervous about, and the grogs read body language better than words. The chief lived in an old farmhouse, apparently. On the lower level, the walls had been mostly pulled away to admit air, but the upper rooms remained intact. Valentine wondered how many wives were crammed into the aluminum-sided seraglio. Stripped old farm equipment stood in the center of the village, a playland junkyard for the little grogs. They swung and climbed and chased each other and an assortment of village dogs in and out of old harvesting tubing, control cabs, and engine housings. At the edge of the playland, a scrubbed and polished clawfoot bathtub served as a central drinking trough. As the chief emerged from his house, huddled amongst his sub-chiefs and elders, Valentine extracted a 2-pound bag from his trade goods and moved quickly toward the big drinking cistern. An elderly female tried to stop him, slapping at his hands. Valentine ignored her and emptied the packet, full of granules that looked like sand, into the trough. Valentine stuck his hand in the water, mixing the water as it began to froth.
What the hell's that?
Root beer mix.
Valentine took his canteen cup. He refilled it and offered it to the grandmother. The younger grogs were less shy than their elder. The chief surveyed the scene, eyes shaded under a heavy brow. He had huge woolly thighs that looked like a pair of sheep standing close together in a field. One of the youngsters brought him a cup of the mixture.
Good-humored guy.
I'm sure he'd laugh just as hard if his warriors were playing soccer with our heads.
I am White Fang!
The chief waved Valentine and Calislo over with a two-handed gesture that made it look like he was taking an appreciative whiff of his own flatulence.
He didn't just cut one, did he?
Try and look agreeable, no matter what.
It took a while for the negotiations to commence. The sub-chiefs and elders and warriors had to arrange themselves in a semicircle around the visitors, bearing their best captured weapons, flak jackets, and helmets. The most battle-scarred of all of them, both with intentional artistry and in random wounds, held a massive surgical tubing slingshot and two bandoliers of captured hand grenades. White Fang's dozen or so wives stood behind him, the two most heavily pregnant in front of the others, turning now and then to display swollen bellies as proof of the chief's potency. Others gripped their children by the ears to show them how their father conducted himself with strangers. A splendid-looking teen female, almost attractive in her careless lounge, wore the white headband of an unmarried daughter as she rested against White Fang's scarred shoulder. By the wooliness of her thighs, Valentine guessed her to be White Fang's eldest daughter. She wore a long, modest skirt made out of old Disney bedsheets, but she managed to hike it up a little in the direction of the unblooded warriors.
What do the strangers beg of White Fang?
Battle Alliance.
Battle Alliance? With humans? Battle Alliance is for against humans. Why should we not kill you now?
Kill us and you will have battle with humans.
Fuck you up.
If the White Fangs killed them, at least it would be over quick. Warrior enemies would be dispatched quickly and cleanly. The grogs reserve torture for criminals.
Means bad old times. Come soldiers. Come artillery. Come armored car.
Let Armored Car come.
Humans beg help.
Humans beg? Yes?
Double Bloods attack humans. Steal much. Capture many. Double Blood's worst enemy, humans now.
Valentine sensed that the Double Bloods had done their share of raiding on White Fang lands, being just across the river from southern Illinois. He suspected an old feud existed.
Worse than Night Stalkers?
Night Stalkers on other side of Great South River. Double Bloods on human side. Humans stop Night Stalkers. Otherwise, Night Stalkers raid White Fangs.
The uneasy truce, not without the occasional raid and ambush, that had existed in southern Missouri between Groggs and Mankind, dated to the brief Kurian occupation of the Ozarks. Reapers had been loosed into Grogglands to drive them away from Solon's planned Trans-Mississippi Empire. The Groggs were only too happy to see Southern Command return. Callislow reached into his shirt and pulled up a pair of black Reaper teeth interlaced with his dog tags. They were only short ones from the back, but the Groggs recognized them. Callislow held them high and rattled them. Valentine remembered teaching Blake to clean teeth just like those, only smaller, with a brush and baking soda.
Humans beg, Battle Alliance. What Double Bloods stole, White Fangs keep. Who Double Bloods capture, White Fangs release.
Trophies?
All White Fang keep.
The young warriors stirred at the opportunity to impress the prospective mates among the females. A warrior returning home with the blood of an enemy on his blade, or even better, some skulls or scalps, could marry, having proved himself worthy of establishing a household and producing children. White Fang's daughter stared out into the crowd. Valentine followed her gaze to a tall, proud-looking warrior, standing naked with only his weapons, splendidly lush hair hanging from his head and shoulders and upper back. He hadn't wanted to contaminate his clothing with human blood, should it come to that, evidently. He stared back at the girl as she leaned toward her father. White Fang's elbow sent her toppling backward.
Trade root beer?
If Battle Alliance is successful.
Trade licorice?
Yes.
Trade Coca-Cola?
All Coca-Cola same.
An entrepreneur was supposedly bottling RC down in the sugar farms near the Louisiana border. Valentine had seen some cases behind lock and key in Shrivastava's mercantile galaxy. White Fang wouldn't notice the difference, he hoped. White Fang held out his hand, and a senior wife placed a sawed-off double-barreled shotgun in it. He extended the butt end toward Valentine. Valentine wasn't sure what to do. He'd never observed a battle alliance. He just knew the term. But it never hurt to imitate the head honcho in any organization, human or grog. He unslung his own carbine and held it toward White Fang, butt end extended.
Good.
The chief gripped the end of his gun. Valentine wrapped his fingers around the pistol grip of the shotgun.
Humans and White Fangs, fuck Double Bloods up!
The Mississippi, wild and untended since 2022, had carved little islands along its banks for most of its length. Within 24 hours of his promise of Coca-Cola to White Fang, Valentine was swatting mosquitoes and trying to keep from being splashed by the paddlers. Groggs paddled as though they were at war with the river. Groggs had an instinctive knack for warfare. Once they made up their minds, they did everything at the hurry-up. After a conference that lasted long into the night, most of it taken up by definitions of geographic points, Valentine sent Callislow back to Rally Base with a written report. White Fang had called for his warriors, and Groggs loped off in every direction. They left a substantial reserve at the camp, perhaps still fearing a human trick, and a corps of veterans set off with the youngest warriors on the Double Blood hunt. The Groggs were proud of their weapons. They had displayed their prowess to Valentine, sending steel-tipped arrows through entire trunks of trees from bows made out of truck leaf springs. Valentine couldn't even string the bow, let alone draw it, and felt very much like a sham Odysseus. Or driving spears through practice dummies made of old kegs and barrels. The tall young grog White Fang's daughter had made eyes at had a big grog gun and 10 bullets probably donated by his entire family. The 50 caliber rounds were scarce on this patch of riverbank, and Valentine suspected they represented an investment of his whole family in the warrior's future. had used one to shatter an old bowling pin at a distance of a kilometer, making Valentine stand within 10 paces of the target to show that no tricks were involved. With the young males gathered, their chief had led them to war, leaving the old fellow with the slingshot and the hand grenades behind. Valentine felt like a war correspondent watching them hike off in loosely grouped bunches, formed into a diamond shape if you plotted them on a map at any particular point. A poor sort of war correspondent at that, because he could get only a vague sense of their intentions. At first, he feared they were just going to plunge into Southern Command's territory and make straight for the Double Blood Trail. But they proved craftier than that, and took big war canoes down a stream to the Mississippi. The Groggs had watched Valentine sit down in the canoe and unroll a condom over the business end of his carbine. A warrior, with 6 feet of lethal, single-shot steel and wood, showed Valentine how he protected his piece. Valentine recognized a leathery testicular sac, undoubtedly human, closed by a tight drawstring. The Grog had left the hairs intact, probably to help it bleed water. They reached the islands opposite Cairo by dark, and Valentine saw smaller scout canoes hooked to either side of White Fang's. Valentine's canoe waited with several others under the metal remnants of an old interstate bridge. They spotted the pulled-up canoes and flatboats and hauled pleasure boats and houseboats floating at anchor, shielded from Southern Command by a long strip of muddy island, tree roots fighting the Mississippi for possession of the soil. With their objective in sight, White Fang let his grogs rest and feed, waiting for the moon to go down. Valentine found himself dozing, resting against a big warm grog who smelled like brackish water. Valentine sat up, watching as 15 scouts slipped into the summer-warmed water at White Fang's signal. As the canoes remained huddled against the banks, the grogs swam or crawled or slithered forward, depending on the depth of water. Valentine's cat-sharp eyes picked out a shadowy shape, glistening wet in the darkness, climb onto a sailboat, and merge with something that looked like a bundle of canvas leaning against a mast. Others of the White Fang tribe emerged from the riverbank and stalked into the trees. Evidently, the Double Bloods hadn't counted on an attack from upriver. A flaming arrow, looking like a bum-winged firefly as it turned tight circles along its parabolic arc into the Mississippi, announced that the scouts had done their job. Valentine moved toward shore with the veteran grogs carrying belt-fed machine guns and laced together Kevlar over their broad frames. Valentine felt sorry for anyone going against this contingent. It was hard enough to get a bullet through grog hide around the shoulders and chest. Add Kevlar to the mix, and you had something resembling a living tank. In the distance, Valentine watched as the victorious grog scout fumbled over the Double Blood sentry's corpse, searching for trophies. The remaining unblooded White Fangs prepared to win their own bloody prizes. The grog caked themselves with mud, dead leaves, and bracken. It would conceal them from the eyes of their enemies and be an earthy burial shroud should they die. By dawn, three Double Blood message runners showed up at the Southern Command bank. Valentine got a good look at one. She looked a little like a bloodhound, with short dark hair, lots of loose skin about the face, and a gangly, underfed look compared to the gray grogs. But the Double Bloods could run like deer and climb like spiders. Even with the arrow that one of the grogs put through her leg from the brush on the riverbank. Valentine didn't care to watch the questioning of the captured messengers, but it amounted to bringing the bigger boats around the south end of the island and setting up boarding ramps big enough for young cattle and pigs. The White Fangs happily followed the plan. They were setting up the inviting-looking boarding ramps and brush blinds for snipers and archers flanking the landing when a Brownwater River patrol motored upriver and turned in to get a good look at the operation, covering the grog boats with what looked like 20-millimeter cannon, while a squat mortar boat watched over matters from mid-river. Valentine slipped into the water off to the side of one of the Double Blood boats, just in case the Quisling stopped to search. He felt the deep Mississippi mud, cool and gritty, around his toes. Luckily, the patrol seemed to recognize the White Fang warrior tattooing. Seeing no use interfering in an internal grog squabble, they steered clear. When the first of the Double Bloods arrived, Valentine stayed in the water with his carbine, waiting in the shadows beneath the gangplank, battle harness with his ammunition wrapped around his neck and shoulders to keep it out of the water. The bullets were supposed to be water resistant. but Valentine had an old soldier's mistrust for allowing muck and gear to mix. A line of warriors loped up, waving to a couple double-blood bodies on the flatboat nailed to wooden staves, gruesome puppets already thick with flies. Groggs, hidden behind the gunwales, worked the arms with bits of cattail. Valentine slipped the condom off his gun barrel. He'd used more of the things keeping water out of his barrel than he'd had in sexual assignations. Not that one of Southern Command's rough-and-ready prophylactics could compete with the artfully wrapped, gossamer-skinned little numbers smuggled in from Asia at great expense that he tried in Fran Paoli's well-appointed bedroom back in Ohio. The advance party fell to a hail of arrows. Two in the rear managed to figure out what was happening in time to shoulder their carbines, but not to shoot. Valentine knew Grog's sniper checkdowns all too well. Obvious officers, then anyone giving signals of any kind, then machine gunners. Sometimes they wouldn't even use their precious bullets on ordinary soldiers. The Grogs didn't have time to clear away the bodies before things went badly. The main body of Doublebloods were close behind their guard, driving herds of cattle, geese, and swine. Blindfolded human captives, linked by dowels and collars at the neck, staggered under yokes with more bags of loot attached, or pushed wheelbarrows. Even as animals fled every which way and humans became entangled and fell, dragging their comrades down with them, more and more Doublebloods arrived, seemingly from all points west. The arrival of their rear guard gave the Doublebloods the advantage. Now it was the White Fangs who were pinned. Two Doublebloods even managed to set up a knee mortar, aiming the muzzle toward the riverbank. Grogs hated artillery. Many of the younger warriors crept back to the water. Valentine spotted a group of Doublebloods forcing their way toward the boats, using cattle as bleeding, lowing shields, splitting the White Fangs. Valentine took aim at the shapes moving in the cow dust. Luckily, some of the Grogs on the boats had a better plan. They cut the anchors and sent the boats nearest the bank off downstream. Seeing their salvation float away took the heart out of the Doublebloods. They broke and scattered for the woodline, abandoning their prizes. Valentine emerged from the river and fell in behind the cover of a thick trunk of a tall tree. He noted that the warriors avoided superior firepower by exploding from cover to cover in short hops. The Doublebloods rear guard stayed together, fighting as they turned north instead of south after the boats. White Fang directed his most experienced warriors after them. It gave Valentine a chance to go to the captives. Using his utility knife, Valentine started cutting ropes and unhooking yokes.
Much blad, son.
He's a renegade. He's with these other stoops. We're just out of the frying pan and into the fire.
No, sir. This is a joint operation of sorts. Southern Command will be along in a bit to offer assistance.
A bit turned out to be about 15 minutes. Valentine stood among the freed captives, waving one of the men's grubby yellow cotton shirt.
Friendly here!
Luckily, someone recognized him from Rally Base and waved him forward as the Grogs collected and organized their loot.
So, you're the Grog lover.
Valentine heard the expression with a pang. He'd had it shouted to him now and then as he rode next to Anka on the long drive into Texas after Archangel had freed the Ozarks. It had angered him then, Anka being worth any three of Southern Command's men. Now, it just made him miss Anka. He'd spent months in eastern Kentucky chasing rumors. No time to think about that. Or the possibilities High Beam presented.
You can call me Sir, Corporal. The White Fangs just saved Southern Command another small war. This was just a raiding party. If the Doublebloods had come across the river with a couple of their warrior regiments, Rally Base would have been scratched.
Sorry, sir.
Of course, that younger Valentine who'd watched Nishino fall might have doubted this road-worn, tired Valentine, too. He had willow leaves in his hair, and his boots were drifting down the Mississippi on the flatboat. Valentine had been able to hand over custody of the rescued captives later that afternoon. The tension was so thick between Southern Command and the White Fangs that he was afraid one wrong move could have led to violence. Luckily, a few hours after, the tension had been cut by the smell of a roasting hog. Valentine carried a platter with a cooked haunch and presented it to the Ozark boys.
Compliments of White Fang.
Thank you, sir.
Valentine saw a private extract a bottle of RC from his sack, smacking his lips at the scent of hot pork fat and crispy skin.
Excuse me, son. Can I buy that off you?
I don't know, sir. You don't look like you got enough.
Just give it to him, dummy!
A Grog veteran probably would have grabbed the younger warrior by the long hair on his shoulders and given him a shake. But Valentine recognized correction when he heard it.
carry it all this damn way and just come and take it.
Hey, White Fang, try this.
Not so for Coley.
Try it.
Valentine wondered if the White Fangs would be up for a march on Atlanta. Most of the cokes he'd had in his life bore an Atlanta gunworks imprint. The grog took a generous swig.
White Fang like.
Good?
More, yes?
Soon.
Valentine temporized, wondering if one of the Srivastava clan would be brave enough to open a small post in White Fang territory. A little cautious trading took place between the soldiers and their usual adversaries. Southern Command offered jars of honey or wrapped pieces of taffy or can openers or clasped knives in exchange for grog machete sheaths and wrist protectors or earrings. Valentine facilitated where he could, using a half-gnawed pork rib as a pointer. He found himself smiling more than he had at any time since that 4th of July gathering. It wouldn't last, of course. Some grog would kill a pack trader, looking for loot and a trophy to show his prospective bride's family, or a hot-headed sergeant would teach cattle-rustling grogs a lesson in the language of the noose. Then matters would flare up and not be calmed down until the next holiday or bad weather season. The past was done, and the future would come soon enough. If better than 30 years on Vampire Earth had taught David Stewart Valentine anything, it was to enjoy the good moments for what they were. Stipple Field, Arkansas, October. The skeleton of Southern Command's short-lived Air Force school. There was a time when Southern Command had a substantial fleet of aircraft and helicopters. Accidents and lack of spares had reduced the fleet to a few choppers and long-wearing crop dusters or air shuttles, Frankenstein flyers operating on the parts of dozens of dead ships. 20 years ago, the airfield, tower, hangars, and office space of Stipple Field had trained younger pilots and mechanics to handle and fix Southern Command's air wing, but with so few craft left, the school only operates for 2 months in the winter as experienced pilots and mechanics test and give initial training to the few recruits they need. In the summer, Stipple hosts the Cadet Games, where promising youngsters compete in marksmanship, riding, and athletic and academic face-offs. The rest of the year, a few custodial workers keep the place painted, cut back, and lit. Because the location is remote and easily guarded, low-level conferences between political and military leaders in eastern Arkansas use the facility, mostly to give each side a chance to have grievances heard and smooth over the resulting ruffled feathers over alcohol in the Flyers Club. Currian spies don't pay much attention to Stipple. Nothing important ever was decided or planned there. Which is why Colonel Dots Lambert chose it as the site for the High Beam Conference. David Valentine hated Stippled Field's folding metal chairs, and the hangar lights turned the attendees' faces shades of purple, blue, or green, but that didn't bother him like the chairs. There was something exactly wrong about their design for his butt and lower back. Sitting in it for more than an hour made his bad leg ache and his kidneys hurt. Most days of the High Beam Conference, he was in it for six, wearing his rather ill-fitting militia uniform and a fine new pair of fatigue boots, Dallas-made no less, a present from Colonel Pizarro to replace the ones lost to the Mississippi Current, or a grog scavenger looking for something he could fashion into knee pads. The hateful chairs were arranged in a square in a big cold hangar around a map drawn under the floor in four colors of tape. White for topography, green for Southern Command's routes toward New Orleans, red for known Currian strongholds and Quisling bases, and yellow for notations. It was all bullshit. But well-thought-out bullshit, in Valentine's opinion. Lambert had probably kept a team of officers working in odd hours planning an operation that wouldn't take place. Maybe it was part of the general staff training Valentine had once been set to enter. Lambert did her briefings on whiteboards, which she and her staff worked on for hours each morning and then meticulously washed each night. The sentries for the conference, all of whom were going on the trip, had every reason to be alert. Currian promises of eternal life had found willing ears before. Some maintenance person might figure out a way to get a picture of the map with a micro-digital camera. The first day of the conference had been spent mostly in social activities, as officers got to know each other and inevitable late arrivals trickled in. Southern Command's rather rickety infrastructure did well if you arrived within 24 hours of the time on your travel orders.
Read 'em and weep.
Valentine played cards the first night with a craggy wolf captain named Moitana. Moitana sported streaks of gray in his long, ropey hair, and had once served as a junior lieutenant in Lahav's old Zulu company, Valentine learned. The gods of poker chose not to favor Valentine that night, but Moitana consoled the losers by buying drinks.
Good.
He also received and smoked a cheroot with an agreeable young staff lieutenant named Picare. He had a golden round face, and Valentine thought he'd make a good sun king. Picare was a communications specialist and told Valentine about the latest mesh that was supposed to keep the juice bugs out of the wiring. Picare did enough talking for both of them. Valentine turned in early. After breakfast the next morning, everyone was directed into the hangar. 40 folding chairs, 10 to a side, were arranged in a square around the chalked map. Each chair had a name taped to the backrest. Each person stood in front of his or her chair. A few of the regulars stiffly at ease. A civilian who'd stood sat up again when he realized no one else was sitting. Everyone waited to take their cue from the general, who stood chatting with some lieutenant colonels. General Lehman, in charge of Southern Command's eastern approaches, opened the first day of the conference. The general had a famously heavy mustache that covered most of his lips. He was affectionately known back at Raleigh as the Big Dipper, as the ends of his mustache visited soups and beverages before his taste buds. The moniker might also have referred to his habit of dipping his little silver flea comb in his water glass at the end of the meal. Valentine's name had been put in the line with support and technical staff, judging from the insignia around him. Opposite him sat Moitana and a couple of his poker-playing wolves. A lieutenant with a scarred cheek and absent earlobes, and who Valentine guessed to be a bear, waited at the far end of the row. Only a bear would come to a conference wearing a crisp new uniform shirt with sleeves freshly snipped off. A pop-eyed civilian in a natty sport coat that looked about two sizes too small fidgeted uncomfortably next to the bear. The fresh sunburn and two-wheeler full of reference binders gave Valentine a guess that a quick look at his ID card confirmed he was an expert from Miskatonic. The row of chairs to Valentine's right held General Lehman and the Big Bugs. To his left, guard regulars. The assembly was mostly officers, with a smattering of senior sergeants and neatly dressed civilians seated with the Big Bugs. The chair with the name Lambert taped to it stood empty, as did the one next to it with no name on it. Lambert was present. Valentine had seen her in the hangar office with some other uniforms. She was the closest thing he had to a commander in his ill-defined, ill-starred relationship with Southern Command. Valentine also recognized one civilian to the other side of Lehman, a well-dressed fixer named Simmy. At this distance, Valentine couldn't tell if he still used that rich sandalwood soap or not. Valentine had last smelled it when Simmy came to visit him in prison, when he was offered up as a sacrificial lamb to doubtful Kansas officials who were considering switching sides and feared reprisals. The Kansas uprising hadn't gone as well as most hoped. The Currians brought an army all the way from Michigan across the Mississippi and Missouri rivers and smashed most of the rebellious territories before Southern Command could get there. Simmy ignored him. Valentine, skin crawling as though trying to make a discreet exit, doubted it was out of embarrassment. Lambert and her group arrived. A man on the hard side of middle age with a loose-skinned face that reminded Valentine of a woeful hound stood next to her at the unmarked chair. He wore a plainly cut black coat, trousers, and leather shoes that made him look like either a Mennonite or a backwoods undertaker. Valentine wondered if he was a life weaver, relatives to the Currians and mankind's most powerful allies in the war against the Currians.
Be seated. We're present at a historic moment. You've been brought together for an important campaign. What we have come here to plan is no ordinary op. A new freehold is about to be born. You will all be midwives. Let's just hope it's a live birth. Some of you have heard rumors of High Beam being a move against New Orleans. That's still what it is as far as the various people in your commands who are going to help you organize the men and material ought to think. I expect you all to go to sleep every night with the Creole phrase book next to your bed, and maps of swamps and bayous piled on your desk. Our true objective is an area in the Appalachians. Some of you may have heard what's happening in West Virginia and eastern Kentucky. A coal miners' revolt has grown into a thriving resistance. Usually uprisings like this are stamped out in a few months. But the fellas running the show there vanish every time the Currians think they have them trapped. Well, they've got popular support and friends on both sides of the mountains. Well, we're going to cross the Mississippi in Kentucky and reinforce brigade strength and offer assistance.
Valentine felt a momentary loss of balance. He'd been working out a route of march, but had only a couple companies of wolves and perhaps a contingent of training and technical units in mind when he presented his ideas to Lambert. Lehman gestured to the big bugs behind him.
That's it for me. I'm just here to sign and seal the op orders. You all are going to do the planning over the next 2 weeks. And with 40 of us, I think we can get a little softball going on Wednesdays and Saturdays. I'll handle the rosters and decide who'll be playing and who'll be grilling and baking when. Unless you vote on basketball, that is. My headquarters, barring contingencies, it will be located in the old motel just across the road. I've given most of my staff furlough or dispensed them for training. I'll try to get the pool filled so you can use it if you like. Drop by if you want to sample the liquor and tobacco, General Gids.
Valentine's heart warmed at that. It wasn't often you met a general who knew when to get out of the way. Lambert took over the rest of the welcome briefing. She introduced the big bugs and allowed the other three sides of the squares to present themselves. Valentine was most interested in the first man introduced, Colonel Singh, who would be overall command of the Expeditionary Brigade. Singh had a flat face. Indeed, he looked as though he'd spent some time using it as a battering ram, as it was heavily pocked and built around a big pursed mouth, suggesting he'd been tasting vinegar. After each introduction, Singh's chin dropped and he shifted his eyes to a blank space between his knees. Singh had a lot to think about. A full regiment of 2 battalions of guard regulars would be his responsibility, each with organic light artillery, plus a support battalion with more artillery and anti-armor or anti-reaper weapons. Of course, the men and gear couldn't travel without commissary, transport, and medical companies. Another smaller ad hoc regiment included a full company of wolves, 3 bear teams under the sleeveless lieutenant, and logistics commandos, the Scroungers. Singh's headquarters would have engineers, signals, and intelligence staff, and even a meteorologist and an agronomist. Valentine hoped he had a good chief of staff. When it came time for Valentine to introduce himself, Lambert nodded at him.
David Valentine. Last held the rank of major. Hunters and special operations.
I was wondering what a militia corporal was doing here.
Valentine looked toward the civilian sitting next to Simmy, showing off the fact that she could read shoulder tabs and stripes. Simmy didn't seem to hear her. He was busy refolding his handkerchief.
He's attached to my special operations directory.
Knew he was an SOD.
Lambert moved on, beckoning to the woman next to Valentine, a captain with training and indoctrination who smelled faintly of boiled vegetables and butter. Only one face hadn't been introduced. The person Valentine suspected was a life weaver. If so, he, she, it, was an extraordinary specimen. In Valentine's limited experience, they never mixed with so many humans at one time. He suspected they found all the thoughts and moods stressful or perhaps frightening. The human imagination sometimes wandered into rather dark and nasty corners when not otherwise engaged. Lambert stepped forward again.
You've probably all noticed that I've skipped someone. Brother Mark is an expert on the Currian Zone. He's former New Universal Church with the rank of elector, I believe. He's serving as liaison between Southern Command and the rebels.
Valentine received his second shock of the meeting. An elector was a senior priest with voting privileges that allowed them to set church policy, for all intents and purposes a bishop, though they were technically below bishops and the all-powerful archons. Most Quislings were expected to obey orders from the Currians. Churchmen were trained from childhood to love doing so.
He's also been prominent in the Currian Order longer than I've been alive.
The sorrowful spaniel in black rose.
I'm not sure the guerrillas rate a term like army from such professionals. May I call them partisans without offending anyone? Good. The partisan army in the Virginia's Kentucky borderland triangle isn't like the military as you understand it. It is a small cadre of leaders who go from place to place, where they temporarily swell their numbers in order to destroy a specific objective, be it a mine or a tunnel or a garrison house. With the job done, the guerrillas return to their homes and remove the telltales of their participation. Still with me?
Valentine could tell from the exchanged glances and squeaking shifts in weight the officers were uncomfortable being addressed by a churchman. Or maybe it was the patronizing tone.
There's a potential in that part of the country for a true freehold. With regular soldiers such as yourselves to handle external threats, the populace could organize its own defense on a county-by-county basis. I'd say the population is 6-1 in favor of the guerrillas, though they've seen enough reprisals to be wary of rising up en masse. Not the best specimens in that part of the country, either physical or mental.
Brother Mark let his gaze rove over the room. He settled his stare on Captain Moitana, who had the thumb of his fist pressed to his mouth as if to keep his lips from opening.
Yes. We all know what happened when a rising like this was attempted in Kansas. Unlike Kansas, we already have local fighters in place who've lost their fear of the Kurians. This time, the rising won't take place until your forces arrive and are integrated with the locals.
It's not Kansas. The Kurians are holding on to their mines by their fingernails. A couple strikes on key Kurian-held centers, destruction of the local constabulary, and a few reapers burned out of their basement lairs would greatly further the cause in North America.
A lieutenant colonel named Jala, with the big bugs, put his hand up. He was perhaps the oldest man at the briefing, other than General Lehman. Campaign ribbons under his name lay in neat rows like a brick wall.
That's awfully near Washington. They're tender about that, what with all those church academies and colleges and such. The Kurians in New York and Philly and Pitts would unite.
The Green Mountains are just as close. There's a freehold there, smaller than ours, but they're managing.
Can we count on them to take some of the heat off?
You won't be alone. God sees to that. You'll have friends to the west. The guerrillas are getting help from some of the legworm ranchers in Kentucky. About 4 years ago, the Ordnance, that's the political organization north of the Ohio, for those of you unfamiliar with the area. As I said, the legworm ranchers have grown restive, especially since the Ordnance began conducting raids in their territory, coming after deserters and guerrillas.
Valentine, who had fled into Kentucky from the Ordnance as something between a guerrilla and a deserter, could tell the assembly didn't like their renegade churchmen. The officers were keeping their faces too blank when they listened.
Some of the troops won't like it. That's a long way from home.
Their forefathers went 10 times as far against lesser evils.
Tell them what the gals in Kentucky look like brought up on milk and legworm barbecue. You know that area, Valentine?
They're pretty enough, General. Tough, too. All that time in the saddle. The Back Hill bourbon's pretty smooth. Everyone and his cousin has a recipe. Some of the older ones will want to allot out and become whiskey barons.
Whiskey barons. They'll like the sound of that.